a solid metal gate, and the only giveable thing between them, the Berg's arm, gave. His wrist bent back and his shoulder torqued wildly with this crunching, snapping sound, this horrible liquid pop. And the Berg bounced backward and landed hard on the stairs and slid down a few of them until he came to rest near the bottom. Clutching his arm, moaning, crying, the gate vibrated against the lock.
"Oh, my God!"
the Berg wailed.
"My arm!"
"Let's go," Samuel said.
"Wait," Bishop said. "One more thing."
He walked along the edge of the loading dock until he was just above the Berg, roughly 6 feet over him.
"See, what I'm going to do now," Bishop said over the Berg's feeble crying, "is I'm going to take a leak, and you're not going to do anything about it. And you're not going to fuck with anybody ever again. Because I've got this photo."
Bishop waved the Polaroid at him.
"You should see it. There you are with all that faggot porn. You want this photo to show up in every locker in school? Taped under every desk? Slipped into every single textbook?"
The Berg looked at him, and for a moment the actual sixth-grade mind that was trapped in his giant adult body broke through, and he looked astonished and hurt and pathetic and sad, like an animal stunned in disbelief at having just been kicked.
"Yo,"
he spat out through the crying.
"Then I expect you'll start behaving," Bishop said. "No more picking on Kim. No more picking on anyone."
Bishop undid his belt and unzipped his pants and pulled down his underwear and released a long, strong jet of urine right at Andy Berg, who wailed and turned around to hide from it and screamed. He curled up while Bishop splattered onto his back and shirt and rat tail. Then the two boys gathered their things and left. They didn't speak at all until they parted ways, at the spot where Bishop cut through the woods to Venetian Village and Samuel continued the other way to his own home. Bishop rapped him lightly on the arm and said,
"Be all you can be, soldier,"
then dashed away. That night, the heat wave finally broke. Samuel sat at his bedroom window and watched the thunderstorm drench the whole outside world. The trees in the backyard whipped violently and the sky flashed with lightning. He imagined Andy Berg out in the storm, still trapped, soaking wet. He imagined him shivering and cold and injured and alone. In the morning, the air had that chilly first feeling of autumn. Andy Berg was not in school. The rumor was that he hadn't come home last night. The police were called. Parents and neighbors went out looking. He was finally located in the morning, wet and sick, in the stairwell behind the school. Now he was in the hospital. Nobody mentioned anything about the Polaroids. Samuel guessed the Berg had caught a cold, maybe the flu, from the rain, but Bishop had another theory.
"He'd have to get rid of the porn, right?" he said at recess that day. "I mean, he wouldn't want to be found with those pictures."
"Yeah," Samuel said. "But how?" They sat on the swings, not swinging, watching a game of tag underway across the playground, a game that included Kim Wigley, which was rare, as Kim tended to avoid recess or really any public space with a high Berg bullying potential. Now he played in unselfconscious joy and delight.
"The Berg's in the hospital now," Bishop said. "Probably poisoned, I think."
"Poison how?"
"He ate them. The photos. That's how he got rid of them."
Samuel tried to imagine eating a Polaroid picture, chewing that hard plastic, swallowing those sharp, heavy corners.
"He ate them?" he said. "Absolutely."
Across the playground, Kim glanced at them and offered Bishop a feeble wave. Bishop waved back. Then he laughed and said, "Hoo-ah!" and ran over to join the game. Actually, almost skipped over there, barely even touching the ground as he went. 8. The Blessed Heart Academy headmaster could be seen lately taking short, plodding walks along Venetian Village's lone street, usually around sunset, shuffling his great heft carefully and gingerly, as if his legs could at any moment shatter. The cane he walked with was a recent acquisition, and the headmaster seemed to enjoy how regal it made him look. It was actually pretty incredible how his stooped body and painful-looking limp could be improved so much by the simple addition of a cane. Now he seemed nobly impaired, like a war hero. The cane's shaft was made of oak and stained to a rich ebony. A pearl handle was attached to the top by a pewter collar etched with patterns of fleur-de-lis. Neighbors were relieved at the addition of the cane because it made the headmaster's pain not quite so visibly obvious, and so they did not feel required to ask him how he felt, and thus they did not have to endure yet another conversation about the sickness. This was a topic that had frankly run itself dry in the last 6 months. The headmaster had by now told all his neighbors about the sickness, the mysterious affliction that no doctor could diagnose and no medicine could cure. The symptoms were well known up and down the block: tightness in his chest, shallow breathing, profuse sweating, uncontrollable salivation, abdominal cramps, blurry vision, fatigue, lethargy, general all-over weakness, headache, dizziness, loss of appetite, slow heartbeat, and an odd, involuntary twitching and rippling of the muscles just under his skin that he would horribly show to neighbors if it flared up while they were talking. The spells came either in the middle of the day or in the middle of the night, lasting roughly 4 to 6 hours before magically ceasing on their own. He was shockingly candid and personal about the details of his condition. He spoke in that manner of people experiencing catastrophic illness, how the illness eclipsed previous gentlemanly notions of modesty and privacy. He told people how confusing it was, priority-wise, when he needed to vomit and diarrhea at the same time. The neighbors nodded and smiled tightly and tried not to betray how awful this was to listen to because their children, and indeed all the children of Venetian Village, attended Blessed Heart Academy, and it was widely known that the headmaster could pull some serious strings. One phone call from him to the Dean of Admissions at Princeton or Yale or Harvard or Stanford could improve a child's chances by about 1,000%. Everyone knew this, so they suffered the headmaster's long and vivid descriptions of medical procedures and bodily effluence because they thought of it as a kind of investment in their child's education and future. So yes, they knew about his many trips to various expensive specialists, allergists, oncologists, gastroenterologists, cardiologists, his MRIs and CT scans, and unpleasant organ biopsies. He made the same joke every time about how the best money he'd spent so far was on his cane. It was, as canes go, breathtakingly beautiful, the neighbors had to agree. He maintained that the best medicine was being active and outdoors, thus his evening walks and twice-daily soaks, once in the morning, once at night, in his backyard saltwater hot tub, which he said was one of the few joys left in his life. Some of the less charitable neighbors insisted privately that the reason for his evening walks wasn't health, but the opportunity to complain for an hour like the goddamn sympathy-seeking tyrant he really was. They would not tell this to anyone else, maybe a spouse, but that's it, because they knew how selfish and insensitive and callous it sounded, that the headmaster was genuinely sick with a mysterious illness that caused a terrific amount of pain and mental anguish, and yet they were the ones who felt like victims. They were the ones who felt aggrieved because they were forced to listen to it. And sometimes on these nights they felt under siege, attending to the headmaster for 60 tedious minutes before getting rid of him and retiring to their entertainment rooms to try to squeeze some enjoyment out of what was left of the evening. They turned on the television and saw some news story about another goddamn humanitarian crisis, another goddamn civil war in some godforsaken place, and saw images of wounded people or starving children and felt a bright, bitter anger at the children for invading and ruining the only moments of relaxation and me time the neighbors had all day. The neighbors would get a little indignant here about how their own lives were hard too, and yet nobody heard them complaining about it. Everyone had problems. Why couldn't they just quietly deal with them? On their own? With a bit of self-respect? Why did they have to get everyone else involved? It's not like the neighbors could do anything. It's not like civil wars were their fault. Of course, they would never say this out loud. And the headmaster never suspected they thought this. But some of his most proximate neighbors had taken to leaving the lights off and sitting around in the dusky darkness until they saw him pass by. Others arranged early dinners out at restaurants at prime headmaster walking times. Certain homes down the block had perfected a system of total avoidance, which was why the headmaster sometimes made it all the way to the end of the cul-de-sac and knocked at the Fall household door and asked to come in for some coffee, which was what happened the first time Samuel was allowed to spend the night at Bishop's house. His first sleepover. Samuel's dad drove him and was plainly stunned when they pulled up to Venetian Village's large front copper gates.
"Your friend lives here?" he said.
Samuel nodded.
The security guard at the gate asked to see Henry's license, asked him to fill out a form, sign a waiver, and explain the nature of his visit.
"We're not going to the White House," he told the guard.
It was not a joke. There was venom in his voice.
"Do you have any collateral?" the guard asked.
"What?"
"You have not been pre-approved, so I'll need some collateral to insure against damages or violations."
"What do you think I'm going to do?"
"It's policy. Do you have a credit card?"
"I'm not going to give you my credit card."
"It's only temporary, like I said, for collateral purposes."
"I'm just dropping off my son."
"You're leaving your son? Okay, that will do."
"For what?"
"For collateral."
The guard actually followed them in a golf cart, and Henry delivered Samuel to the Fall House with a brief hug, said, "Be good, and call me if you need me," and then glared pure hatred at the security guard as he got back into his car. Samuel watched as both his father and the golf cart disappeared up Via Veneto. He held his backpack, which contained some overnight clothes, and at the bottom the cassette tape he'd bought at the mall for Bethany. Tonight, he would give her the present. They were all there. Bishop, Bethany, their parents, they were all waiting, in the same room which Samuel had never seen before, all of them inhabiting the same space at the same time. And another person, too, at the piano. Samuel recognized him. The headmaster. The same headmaster who had expelled Bishop from Blessed Heart Academy now sat taking up all the space on the bench in front of the family's Bösendorfer baby grand. "Hi there," Samuel said, to nobody in particular, to the aggregate mass of them.
"So you're the friend from the new school,"
the headmaster said. Samuel nodded.
"It's good to see he's fitting in," the headmaster said.
This remark was made about Bishop, but it was made to Bishop's father. Bishop sat in an upholstered antique wooden chair and looked small. It was as if the headmaster's large presence had colonized the room. He was one of those men whose body exactly matched his disposition. His voice was big, his body was big, he sat bigly, his legs far apart and his chest puffed out. Bishop inhabited the farthest seat from the headmaster, arms crossed, feet under him, a tight little angry ball. He leaned so far back in his chair it seemed he wanted to physically dissolve into it. Bethany sat nearer the piano, perfectly upright, as she always did, on the edge of her chair, ankles crossed, hands in her lap.
"Back to it,"
the headmaster said. He swiveled to face the piano and placed a hand on the keys.
"Now don't cheat."
Bethany turned her head away from the piano and looked directly at Samuel. His chest seized. Her stare carried such voltage, he fought the urge to look away. The headmaster pounded a single note on the piano, a strong, dark, low note that Samuel could feel in his body. "That's an A," Bethany said.
"Correct,"
the headmaster said.
"Again."
Another note, this time near the top of the keyboard, a delicate plink.
"That's C," Bethany said.
She still stared at Samuel, expressionless.
"Right again,"
the headmaster said.
"Let's make it more challenging."
He hit three keys at once, and what came out was dissonant and ugly. It sounded like what an infant might do bashing the piano incoherently. Bethany's stare seemed to disengage for a moment. It was as if her consciousness receded, the way her eyes went glassy and remote. But then she came back and said,
"B-flat, C, C-sharp."
"That's amazing,"
the headmaster said, clapping.
"Can I go?" Bishop said.
"I'm sorry,"
his father said. "What was that?"
"Can I go?" Bishop said.
"Maybe if you learn to ask correctly." And here Bishop finally raised his head and met his father's eyes. They held each other's gaze like that for an uncomfortable few seconds.
"May I please be excused?" Bishop said.
"Yes, you may."
In the game room, it was clear Bishop did not want to talk. He jammed Missile Command into the Atari. He sat stone-faced and quiet while he shot rockets out of the air. Then Bishop grew agitated and said, "Fuck this, let's watch a movie." And he started a film they'd seen several times before, about a group of teenagers who defend their town from a surprise Russian invasion. They were about 20 minutes into the movie when Bethany opened the door and slipped in. He's gone, she said. Good. Samuel could not believe how much his stomach flopped whenever he saw her up close. Even now, when he felt seriously conflicted about his presence here, when Bishop transparently wanted to be alone and Samuel didn't know what to do with himself and had been wondering if he should call his father and go back home, even through all this, Samuel felt elated when Bethany entered the room. It was as if she erased every lesser thing. Samuel had to bat away his impulses to touch her, to muss up her hair or punch her in the arm or flick her earlobe or any of the other juvenile maneuvers boys do to terrorize the girls they love. Maneuvers that were really meant to bring them into physical contact, the only way they knew how. Brutally, like little barbarians. But Samuel knew enough to know this was not a good long-term strategy. So he sat there, heavy and still, on his usual beanbag chair and hoped Bethany would sit next to him. "He's an asshole," Bishop said. "A fat fucking asshole."
"I know," Bethany said.
"Why do they let him in the house?"
"Because he's the headmaster, but also because he's sick."
"That's ironic."
"He wouldn't be out walking around if he weren't sick."
"If there's a word for that, it's ironic."
"You're not listening," Bethany said. "You wouldn't see him if you weren't sick."
Bishop sat up and frowned at his sister.
"Just what are you trying to say?"
Bethany stood there with her hands behind her back, chewing or biting the inside of her cheek the way she did when she was concentrating real hard. Her hair was pulled into a ponytail. Her eyes were so fiercely green. She was wearing a yellow sundress that gradually turned white at the bottom.
"I'm pointing out a fact," Bethany said. "If he weren't sick, he wouldn't go for these walks, and then you wouldn't have to see him."
"I don't think I like where this is going." "What are you guys talking about?" Samuel said. "Nothing," they said in twin-like unison. The three of them watched the rest of the movie in an edgy silence, watched as the American team successfully fought off the Russian aggressors, and the triumphant ending of the movie was not nearly as triumphant as it usually felt because the room was overflowing with some weird tension and unspoken conflict, and it felt to Samuel like he was back home having dinner with his parents while they were going through one of their moments, and when the movie finished, the kids were told to get ready for bed. And so they washed up and brushed their teeth and changed into their pajamas, and Samuel was led to the guest bedroom. And just before they were told to turn off the lights, Bethany softly knocked on the door and poked her head in his room and said, "Good night." "Good night," he said. She looked at him and lingered there a moment like she had something else to say. "What were you doing?" Samuel said, "earlier, with the piano."
"Oh, that," she said. "Parlor tricks."
"You were performing?"
"Sort of. I can hear things. People think it's special. My parents like to show it off."
"What things?"
"Notes, pitches, vibrations."
"From the piano?"
"From everything. The piano is easiest because all the sounds have names, but really from everything."
"What do you mean, from everything?"
"Every sound is actually many sounds put together," she said. "Triads and harmonics, tones and overtones."
"I don't get it."
"A knock on the wall, a tap on a glass bottle, birdsong, tires on the street, the phone ringing, the dishwasher running. There's music in everything."
"You hear music from all that?"
"Our phone is a little sharp," she said. "It's awful every time it rings."
Samuel tapped on the wall, listening. "I only hear a thud."
"There's a lot more than a thud. Listen, try to separate the sounds."
She knocked sharply on the door frame.
"There's the sound made by the wood, but the wood is not a constant density, so it makes a few different pitches, very close together."
She knocked again.
"Then there's the sound of the glue, the surrounding wall, the hum of the air inside the wall."
"You hear all that?"
"It's there. You add it up and it sounds like a thud. It's a very brown noise, like if you melted all the colors in the crayon box. This is the sound you'd get."
"I don't hear any of that."
"It's harder to hear out in the world. A piano is tempered. A house is not."
"That's amazing."
"Mostly, it's annoying."
"Why?"
"Well, take birds. There's this one bird, the tanager, that makes this sound like chip-chirree. Chirree, chirree. Okay? It's a summer bird."
"Okay.
But I don't really hear the chirree. What I hear is a third and a fifth in A-flat major.
I don't know what that means.
It's a C gliding into an E-flat, which is exactly what happens in this one Schubert solo, and also in a Berlioz symphony, and also in a Mozart concerto. So the birds start singing and it ignites all these phrases in my head.
I wish I had that.
No, it's terrible. It's all crashing around in there.
But you have music in your brain. Mostly what I have is worry.
She smiled. I just want to be able to sleep in the morning, she said. But there's this tanager right outside my window. I wish I could turn him off, or turn my head off, one of the two.
I have something for you, Samuel said. A present.
You do?
Something from the mall.
The mall?
She said, confused. But her face brightened as she registered the connection.
Oh, the mall, right.
Samuel rummaged through his backpack and produced the cassette. It was shiny, still wrapped in tight plastic. It struck him now that it was such a small thing, about the size and weight of a deck of playing cards. Too small, he thought, to be as meaningful as he needed it to be. He was seized with panic about this, and so he handed it to her quickly, jammed it at her fast and hard so he wouldn't chicken out. Here's this, he said.
What is it?
It's for you. She took the cassette in her hand. It's from the mall, he said. In the daydreams he'd been having, Bethany would, at this moment, smile brightly and wrap her arms around him and express her disbelief and wonderment that he'd chosen such an exactly perfect gift, how he must understand her on a deep level and really get what's going on in her head and have a similarly interesting and artistically fulfilling inner life himself. But the expression now forming on Bethany's face was not that. The creases around her eyes and on her forehead... It was like how people squint when they're trying to understand someone with a thick and frustrating accent.
Do you know what this is? She said.
It's really modern stuff, he said, repeating the cashier at the mall. It's really out there.
I can't believe they made a recording of this, she said.
They made 10 recordings, he said. It's the same piece recorded 10 times. Bethany started laughing now, and it was a laugh that made him understand that, for reasons he was not aware of, he was an idiot. There was an essential bit of information he was missing.
What's so funny, he said. This piece, she said, it's sort of a joke.
What do you mean?
It's all silence, she said. The entire thing is just silence.
He stared at her, not really comprehending this. There are no notes in the score, she said. It was actually performed once. The pianist sat at the piano and did nothing.
How could he do nothing?
He just sat there counting the beats, and then he was done. That was the piece.
I can't believe they made a recording.
10 recordings. It was sort of a put-on. It's very famous.
So this whole cassette, he said, is blank?
I guess that's part of the joke.
Shit.
No, it's great, she said, clutching the tape against her chest.
Thank you. Really, it's quite thoughtful.
Quite thoughtful. Samuel kept thinking about the way she said this. Long after she left and he'd turned out the lights and covered his whole body and head with blankets and curled up and lightly cried. How quickly his daydreams had given way to this merciless reality. He thought bitterly about his expectations for the night and how everything had gone so very wrong. Bishop didn't want him here. Bethany was indifferent. The gift was a failure. This was the price of hope, he realized. This shattering disappointment.
He must have fallen asleep like that because he woke up hours later under the covers, curled, hot, and sweaty in the darkness, as Bishop shook him and said, "Wake up, let's go."
Samuel followed him groggily. Bishop told him to put on his shoes, told him to climb out the first floor TV room window. Samuel did all this in a half-awake stupor.
"Follow me,"
Bishop said when they were outside, and they walked up Via Veneto's gentle slope in the total darkness and silence of the night. It must have been 2 in the morning, maybe 3. Samuel wasn't sure. There was such an odd stillness at this time. No sound, no wind. There was barely even weather. The only noises were the occasional click of a sprinkler head turning on and the low groan of the headmaster's hot tub. Automated, mechanical noises. Bishop walked with purpose, maybe even arrogance. This was a different walk than when they played war games in the woods and Bishop hid behind trees and dove between bushes.
Now he walked in plain view, right down the middle of the road.
"You'll need these," he said,
and handed Samuel a pair of blue plastic gloves, the kind people use for gardening. The fit was loose. They must have been Bishop's mother's. The gloves came up to Samuel's elbows, and each finger had an inch or so of floating empty space.
"Over here,"
Bishop said, and he led them to a spot near the headmaster's house where the lush, thick lawn met the wild forest. There stood a metal post about as tall as the boys themselves, on top of which was a block of white salt, its surface smooth and spotted with brown specks. On top of the salt block was a copper disc. Bishop reached for the disc and pulled at it, trying to twist it off.
"Help me with this," he said,
and they yanked at the cap until it finally budged. Up close like this, breathing hard, Samuel could smell the feral animal scent coming from the contraption, but also something else, something like sulfur, that rotten egg smell coming from the salt itself. At this range, he could read the sign affixed halfway up the post. "Danger. Poison. Keep away."
"This is what kills the deer, isn't it?" Samuel said. "Grab your side."
They slid the block off the post. It was surprisingly heavy and dense. They carried it toward the headmaster's house.
"I don't think I want to do this," Samuel said. "We're almost there."
They walked slowly, the big gray block between them, around the headmaster's pool and up the two steps to the hot tub, which was steaming, gently circulating, a small light at the bottom shining blue.
"In there," Bishop said, pointing his chin at the hot tub.
"I don't think I want to."
"On three," he said, and they heaved forward, then back, once, twice, three times, and then let go.
They tossed the block into the water, where it was swallowed with a splash, followed by a low thud as it landed at the bottom of the tub.
"Good job," Bishop said.
They watched the block come to rest down there, its image distorted by the shimmering water.
"That'll dissolve by morning," Bishop said. "No one will know."
"I want to go home," Samuel said.
"Come on,"
Bishop said. And taking him by the arm, they walked back down the street. When they reached the house, Bishop opened the TV room window, then stopped.
"You want to know what happened in the principal's office?" Bishop said. "Why I didn't get spanked?"
Samuel was holding back tears, wiping his runny nose with the sleeve of his pajamas.
"It was actually really easy," Bishop said. "The thing you have to understand is that everyone is afraid of something. As soon as you know what someone fears most, you can make them do whatever you want."
"What did you do?"
"So he had his paddle, right? And he told me to bend over the table, right? So I took off my pants."
"You did what?"
"I unbuckled my belt and took off my pants and my underwear and everything. I was naked from the waist down, and then I said, 'Here's my ass. You want it?'"
Samuel stared at him.
"Why would you do that?" "I asked him if he liked my ass and wanted to touch it."
"I don't understand why you would do that."
"He got pretty weird then."
"Yeah."
"He stared at me for a long time and then told me to put my clothes back on. Then he took me back to class. That was it. Easy."
"How did you even think to do that?"
"Anyway," Bishop said, "thanks for your help tonight."
He climbed through the window. Samuel followed and padded through the dark house, returning to the guest bedroom, getting into bed, then getting out again and finding a bathroom and washing his hands 3, 4, 5 times. He could not decide if the burning sensation in his fingers was from the poison or if it was in his mind. 9. The invitation appeared in the mailbox in a square envelope of heavy cream-colored paper. Samuel's name was written on the front in very precise girl handwriting.
"What's this?" Faye said.
"Birthday invite?" He looked at the envelope and then at his mother.
"Pizza party?" she said.
"At the roller rink?" "Stop it."
"Who's it from?"
"I don't know."
"Maybe you should open it."
Inside was an invitation printed on expensive cardstock. It shimmered as if flecks of silver had been added to the pulp. The writing looked like it was pressed in gold leaf, a swirling, swooping cursive that said,
please join us at the Blessed Heart Academy Cathedral as Bethany Fall performs the Bruch Violin Concerto No. 1. Samuel had never been invited to anything in this manner, lavishly. At school, the invitations to birthday parties were generic, slipshod affairs, cheap, thin cards with animals on them or balloons. This invitation felt actually physically heavy. He handed it to his mother. "Can we go?" he said. She studied the invitation and frowned. "Who's this Bethany?" "A friend." "From school?" "Sort of." "And you know her well enough to get invited to this?" "Can we go, please?" "Do you even like classical music?"
"Yes."
"Since when?"
"Since I don't know."
"That's not an answer."
"Mom,
the Bruch Violin Concerto? Do you even know what that is?"
"Mom."
"I'm just saying, are you sure you can appreciate it?"
"It's a very difficult piece and she's been practicing for months."
"And you know this how?"
Samuel then made an angry, abstract sound meant to convey his frustration and unwillingness to further discuss the matter of the girl, which came out something like, "Grrrr!"
"Fine," she said with a satisfied little grin.
"We'll go."
The night of the concert, she told him to dress nice.
"Imagine it's Easter," she said.
So he put on the fanciest things in his closet, a stiff and itchy white shirt, a black necktie bound noose-tight, black slacks that popped with static electricity when he moved, a shiny pair of dress shoes that he shoehorned himself into, so granite hard they removed a layer of skin on his heel. He wondered why adults felt they needed to be at their most uncomfortable for their most cherished events. The Blessed Heart Academy Cathedral was already buzzing when they arrived, people in suits and flowery dresses filing into the large arched doorway, the sounds of musicians practicing audible even from the parking lot. The cathedral was built to mimic the great churches of Europe at about one-third scale. Inside, a wide central aisle was flanked on both sides by pews made of heavy and thick and ornately carved wood, polished and shining wetly. Beyond the pews were stone columns with torches attached about 15 feet above the crowd, each lit with glowing fires. Parents chatted with other parents, the men giving soft platonic kisses to the cheeks of women. Samuel watched them, these small pecks, and realized the men weren't really kissing the women, but instead miming a kissing action into the area around their necks. Samuel wondered if the women were disappointed about this. They'd been expecting a kiss, and all they got was air. They took their seats, studied the program. Bethany would not go on until the second half. The first half was all smaller works, minor chamber pieces and quick solos. It was clear Bethany's piece was the showstopper, the big finale. Samuel's feet bounced nervously on the soft, carpeted floor. The lights dimmed and the musicians stopped their chaotic warm-ups and everyone took their seats, and after a lengthy pause there came a sturdy note out of the woodwinds. Then everyone else following it, tuning to that note, anchoring themselves to that spot, and something seemed to catch in his mother's throat. She inhaled sharply, then put her hand on her chest.
"I used to do that," she said.
"Do what?"
"The tuning note. I was the oboe. That used to be me."
"You played music?
When?"
"Shh." And there it was, another secret his mother had kept. Her life was a fog to him. Whatever happened before he came along was all mysterious, locked behind ambiguous shrugs and half-answers and vague abstractions and aphorisms. "You're too young," she'd say, or, "You wouldn't understand." Or the particularly infuriating, "I'll tell you someday when you're older." But occasionally some secret would crack free, so his mother was once a musician. He added it to the mental inventory. Things that Mom is. She's a musician. What else? What other things didn't he know about her? She had acres of secrets, it was obvious. He always felt there was something she wasn't saying, something behind her bland, partial attention. She often had that disassociated quality, like she was focusing on you with maybe one-third of herself, the rest devoted to whatever things she kept locked inside her head. The biggest secret had slipped years earlier, when Samuel was young enough to be asking his parents ridiculous questions. "Have you ever been in a volcano? Have you ever seen an angel?" Or asking because he was still naive enough to believe in stupendous things. "Can you breathe underwater? Can all reindeer fly?" or asking because he was fishing for attention and praise. How much do you love me? Am I the best child in the world? Or asking because he wanted to be reassured of his place in the world. Will you be my mom forever? Have you been married to anyone besides Dad? Except when he asked this last question, his mother straightened up and looked at him, all tall and solemn and serious, and said, "Actually." She never finished that sentence. He waited for her, but she stopped and thought about it and got that distant, bleak look on her face. "Actually what?" he said. "Nothing," she said. "Never mind." "You've been married before?" "No." "Then what were you going to say?" "Nothing." So Samuel asked his father, "Was Mom ever married to anyone else?"
"What?"
"I think she might have been married to someone else."
"No, she wasn't. Jesus, what are you talking about?"
Something had happened to her. Samuel was sure of it. Some profound thing that even now, years later, occupied her attention. It washed over her sometimes, and she disengaged from the world. Meanwhile, there was a concert happening. High school boys and girls playing important senior year recitals. 5 to 10 minute pieces that were right in the strike zone of each student's ability. Loud clapping after every performance. Pleasant, easy, tonal music, mostly Mozart. Then it was intermission. People stood and made their way elsewhere, outside, to smoke, or to a nearby buffet table for cheese. "How long did you play music?" Samuel asked. His mother studied the program. She acted like she didn't hear him. "This girl, your friend, how old is she?"
"My age," he said. "She's in my grade." "And she's playing with these high schoolers?"
He nodded his head. "She's really good." And he felt this surge of pride just then, as if being in love with Bethany meant something important about him, as if he were rewarded for her accomplishments. He would never be a musical genius, but he could be a person a musical genius loved. Such were the spoils of love, he realized, that her success was also, by some odd refraction, his.
"Dad's really good, too," Samuel added. She looked at him, puzzled.
"What are you talking about?"
"Nothing. It's just, you know, he's really good. At his job."
"That's an odd thing to say."
"It's true. He's very good."
She stared at him a moment, mystified. "Did you know," she said, looking down at the program again, "that the composer of this piece never made any money from it?"
"Which piece?"
"The piece your friend is going to play. The guy who wrote it, Max Bruch. He never earned a penny."
"Why not?"
"He was cheated. It was around World War I, and he was bankrupt, so he gave it to a couple of Americans who were supposed to send him the money, but they never did. The score disappeared for a long time, then ended up in the vault of J.P. Morgan."
"Who's that?"
"A banker, industrialist, financier."
"A really rich guy?"
"Yes, from a long time ago."
"He liked music?"
"He liked things," she said. "It's a classic story. The robber baron gets more stuff. The artist dies with nothing."
"He didn't die with nothing," Samuel said.
"He was broke. He didn't even have the score."
"He had his memory of it."
"His memory?"
"Yeah, he could still remember it. That's something." "I'd rather have the money."
"Why?" "Because when all you have is the memory of a thing," she said, "all you can think about is how the thing is gone."
"I don't think that's true."
"You're young." The lights dimmed again, and people around them took their seats, and the buzz of small talk quieted, and everything went dark and silent, and the whole cathedral seemed to distill itself into one small circle of light at the front of the altar, a spotlight illuminating an empty bit of floor.
"Here we go," his mother whispered.
Everyone waited. It was agony. 5 seconds, 10 seconds, it was taking too long. Samuel wondered if someone had forgotten to tell Bethany she was on, or if she left her violin at home. But then he heard the click of a door somewhere in front of him. Then footsteps, soft shoes on the hard floor. And finally there she was, Bethany, gliding into the light. She wore a slim green dress, and her hair had been done up, and she looked, for the first time, tiny. Around all these adults and high schoolers way up in front, it was as if Samuel's normal scale was thrown off. Bethany now looked like a child. And he was worried for her. This was too much to ask, all this. The audience politely clapped. Then Bethany put her violin under her chin. She stretched her neck and shoulders. And without a word,
the orchestra began to play. It started with a low thrum, like thunder very far away, a faint drumming from beyond the light. Samuel could feel it in his torso and fingertips. He was sweating. Bethany didn't even have her music. She would do this from memory. What if she forgot? What if she blanked? He realized now how terrifying music is, how inevitable the drums would keep driving forward, whether or not Bethany knew her part. And now, softly, the woodwinds came in. Nothing dramatic, but three simple notes, each lower than the last, repeated. It wasn't a melody, more like a preparation, like they were readying the sanctuary for sound, like these three notes performed the ritual necessary to be in the presence of music. It wasn't the music yet, but rather its leading edge. Then Bethany straightened herself and placed her bow at the proper angle, and it was clear something was about to happen. She was ready. The audience was ready. The woodwinds held a single long, hovering note that gradually faded away, that sounded like taffy stretched to nothingness. And just as that note disappeared, just as it was swallowed by the darkness, a new note leaped from Bethany. It grew stronger and louder, and then she was the only one speaking in that huge hall. There was nothing more lonely than that sound. Like all the heartbreak in someone's long life gathered and distilled, it began low and moaned higher, slowly, a couple of steps up, a few steps back, and so on, like a dancer whirling its way to the top of the scale, more quickly now, to announce at the very peak a kind of forsakenness, a desolation. The way Bethany bent that last note as she climbed into it, it sounded like a cry, like somebody crying. An old, familiar noise, and Samuel felt himself falling into the note, gradually folding himself around it. And just when he thought she'd reached the top, another note came, even higher, a wisp of music, the barest edge of the bow meeting the thinnest string, just the finest sound, clean, noble, soft, a slight quiver from Bethany's rolling finger, like the note itself were alive and pulsing. Alive, but dying, it seemed now, as the note diminished and decayed, and it didn't sound like Bethany's playing softened, but rather like she was moving quickly away from them, like she was being stolen, and wherever she went they could not follow. She was a ghost passing into another realm. Then the orchestra answered back, a full and deep barrel of sound, like they needed all the numbers they could muster to match this one tiny girl in her little green dress. The concert passed in a kind of blur after that. Occasionally, Samuel would be newly amazed by one of Bethany's maneuvers, how she could play on two strings at once and make them both sound good, how she could play so many hundreds of notes perfectly from memory, how fast her fingers moved. It was inhuman what she could do. By the middle of the second movement, Samuel had concluded there was no way he deserved her. The audience went mad. They stood and cheered and gave Bethany bouquets of roses so large they impeded her balance. She carried them in both arms and was barely visible behind them, waving and curtsying.
"Everyone loves a prodigy," his mother said, herself also standing and clapping. "Prodigies get us off the hook for living ordinary lives. We can tell ourselves we're not special because we weren't born with it, which is a great excuse. She's been practicing nonstop for months." "My dad always told me I was nothing special," she said. "I guess I proved him right." Samuel stopped clapping and looked at his mother. She rolled her eyes and patted him on the head. "Never mind. Forget I said that. Do you want to say hi to your friend?"
"No." "Why not?"
"She's busy."
And indeed she was busy, surrounded by well-wishers, friends, family, her parents, various musicians congratulating her.
"You should at least tell her she did a good job," the mother said. "Thank her for the invitation. It's polite."
"Plenty of people are telling her good job," Samuel said.
"Can we go?"
The mother shrugged.
"Okay, if that's what you want."
And they were on their way out of the hall, and they were moving slowly with the surge of people also leaving, Samuel brushing against hips in sport coats, when from behind him he heard his name. Bethany was calling his name. He turned and found her wrestling through the crowd to catch up to him, and when she finally did, she leaned into him, her cheek to his, and he thought he was supposed to give her one of those fake kiss things he saw all the adult men doing until she brought her lips all the way to his ear and whispered,
"Come over tonight. Sneak out."
"Okay," he said. That warmth on his face,
he would have agreed to do anything she asked. There's something I have to show you.
What is it?
The cassette you gave me? It's not just silence. There's something else.
She pulled away. She no longer looked as she had on stage, small. She had regained her normal Bethany proportions, elegant, sophisticated, womanly. She held his stare and smiled.
You have to hear it, she said.
Then she dashed away, back to her parents and her throng of giddy admirers. His mother looked at him suspiciously, but he ignored her. He walked right past her, out of the church and into the night, limping slightly in his rock-hard shoes. That night he lay in bed waiting for the sounds of the house to disappear, his mother rattling around in the kitchen, his father watching television downstairs, then eventually the whoosh of his parents' door opening as his mother went to bed. Then the television turning off with an electric chunk, the sound of water running, a toilet flushing, then nothing. Waiting another 20 minutes to be sure, then opening his door, twisting and untwisting the knobs slowly and tightly to avoid unwanted metallic clicks, walking lightly down the hall, stepping over the squeaky part of the hallway floor that Samuel could avoid even in total darkness, then down the stairs, placing his feet as close to the wall as he could, where there was less creaking danger, then taking a full 10 minutes to open the front door, a small pull, a small tick, then silence, then another tick, the door opening in fractions of an inch until the gap was finally wide enough to pass through. And finally, once liberated, running. In the clean air, running down the block, toward the creek, into the woods that separated Venetian Village from everything else. His foot clomps and breathing were the only sounds in the whole big world, and when he felt afraid of getting caught, of dangerous forest animals, of mad axe murderers, kidnappers, trolls, ghosts, he steeled his mind with the memory of Bethany's warm, wet breath on his ear. Her bedroom was dark when he arrived, her window closed. Samuel sat outside for several long minutes, panting and sweating and watching, reassuring himself that all relevant parents were asleep and that no neighbors would see him creep through the backyard, which, when he finally did, he did so quickly, running on the tips of his shoes to avoid all ground sounds, then crouching below Bethany's window and lightly tapping it with the pad of his index finger until, from out of the darkness, she appeared. He could see only bits of her in the murky nighttime light, the angle of her nose, a toss of hair, collarbone, eye socket. She was a collection of parts floating in ink. She opened the window and he climbed in, rolling over the frame and wincing where the metal bit into his chest. "Be quiet," said someone who was not Bethany, who was elsewhere in the darkness. It was Bishop, Samuel realized after a moment of disequilibrium. Bishop was here, in the room, and Samuel was both disheartened and grateful for this, because he didn't know what he would do if he were alone with Bethany, but also he knew he wanted to do it, whatever it was, to be alone with her. He wanted it very badly. "Hi, Bish," Samuel said. "We're playing a game," Bishop said. "It's called Listen to Silence Until You're Bored Out of Your Mind." "Shut up," Bethany said. "It's called Be Put to Sleep by Cassette Tape Static." "It's not static. It's all static." "It's not only static," she said. "There's something else. Says you." Samuel could not see them. The darkness in here was total. They were more like impressions in space, lighter shapes against the blackness. He tried to place himself in the geography of her room, constructing a map from memory. The bed, the dresser, the flowers on the wall. There were glow-in-the-dark stars dotting the ceiling, Samuel noticed, suddenly, for the first time. Then the sounds of fabric and footsteps and the bed's quick squeak as Bethany probably sat down on it, near where Bishop seemed to be, near the cassette player, which she often listened to at night, alone, playing and rewinding and playing again the same few moments from some symphony, which Samuel knew because of all his spying. "Come up here," Bethany said. "You have to be close." So he got up on the bed and moved slowly toward them, and felt around clumsily and grabbed something cold and bony that was definitely a leg belonging to one of them. He didn't know which. "Listen," she said, "very closely." A click of the tape player, Bethany leaning back into the bed,
the fabric folding around her, then static, as that brief dead space at the beginning of the tape ended and the recording actually began. "See?" Bishop said. "Nothing. Wait for it." The sound was distant and muffled, like when a faucet is turned on somewhere in the house and there's that rushing sound from hidden far-off pipes. "There," Bethany said. "Do you hear it?" Samuel shook his head, then realized she couldn't see the gesture. "No," he said. "There it is," she said. "Listen. It's under the sound. You have to listen below it." "You are making no sense," Bishop said. "Ignore what you can hear and listen to the other stuff." "Listen to what?" "To them," she said. "The people, the audience, the room. You can hear them." Samuel strained to listen. He cocked his head toward the stereo and squinted, as if that would help, trying to pick out any kind of organized sound within the static. Talking, coughing, breathing. "I don't hear anything," Bishop said. "You're not concentrating." "Oh, right, that's the problem."
"You have to focus."
"Fine, I will now attempt to focus." They all listened to the hiss coming out of the speakers, Samuel feeling disappointed in himself that he also had not yet heard anything. Bishop said, "This is me totally focused. Will you shut up?" "I have never been so focused as I am at this moment. Please shut up."
"Concentrate, you must," he said. "Feel the force, you must."
"You can go away, you know, like leave." "Happily," Bishop said, scrambling away and leaping off the bed. "You two enjoy your nothing." The bedroom door opened and closed and they were alone. Samuel and Bethany. Alone together, finally. Terribly. He sat rock still.
"Now listen," she said.
"Okay." He pointed his face in the direction of the noise and leaned in. The static was not a high-pitched, trebly noise, but a deeper kind. It was like a microphone had been suspended above an empty stadium. The silence had a fullness to it, a roundness. It was a substantial quiet. It wasn't just the sound of an empty room, but rather like someone had gone to great lengths to manufacture nothingness. It had a created quality to it. It felt made.
"There they are," Bethany whispered. "Listen."
"The people?"
"They're like ghosts in a graveyard," she said. "You can't hear them the normal way."
"Describe it."
"They sound worried and confused. They think they're being tricked."
"You can hear all that?"
"Sure. It's the stiffness of the sound. It's like those really short, tight strings at the top of the piano, the ones that don't vibrate, the white sounds. That's what these people sound like. They're like ice."
Samuel tried to listen for something like that, some high-pitched buzz inside the droning, persistent static.
"But it changes," she said. "Listen for the change."
He kept listening, but all he could hear was how the sound sounded like other sounds. Escaping air from a bicycle tire, the whir of a small fan, water running behind a closed door. He heard nothing original, only his own mental library bouncing back at him.
"There," she said. "The sound gets warmer. Do you hear it? Warmer and fuller. The sound gets bigger and blooms. They are beginning to understand."
"Understand what?"
"Maybe they're not being tricked. Maybe they're not being mocked. Maybe they're not outsiders. They're beginning to get it. That maybe they're part of something. They're beginning to realize they haven't come here to listen to music. They're beginning to realize that they are the music. They are themselves what they've come here to find. The thought is exhilarating to them. Can you hear it?"
"Yes," Samuel lied.
"They're happy. They are happy."
And Samuel felt himself believing he really could hear this. The same kind of voluntary self-hallucination he felt when he convinced himself at night in bed that there were intruders in the house, or ghosts, and every sound the house made validated this delusion. Or on those days he couldn't bear to go to school and told himself he was sick until he really became sick, felt actually physically ill, and he would wonder how the nausea could be real if he created it in his mind. It was like that, this thing he was hearing. The sound of static really did get warmer the more he thought about it. It really did become a happy static. The sound seemed to broaden in his mind, open up, and burn. Was this her secret, he wondered? That she simply wanted to hear what no one else could? I can hear it now, he said. You just have to chase it.
Yes, she said, that's exactly right.
He felt her hand grasp his shoulder and squeeze, then felt her move closer to him, felt the vibrations and swells in the mattress, the slight creaks of the bed frame as she swiveled around and came into him. She was close. He could hear her breathing, smell her toothpastey breath. But more than that, he could feel her nearby, how she seemed to displace the air, had some kind of electricity around her, how you can sense the closeness of another body, the presence of some kind of magnetism, her heartbeat throttled up, all this coming at him as an impression in space, a map his mind made, an intuition, and then finally as actual, solid matter, the flesh of her face now close enough to comprehend. They were, he realized, going to kiss. Or rather, she was going to kiss him. This was going to happen. All he had to do was not screw it up. But in that moment, in those few seconds between realizing she was going to kiss him and the actual kiss, there seemed to be so many ways to screw it up. He felt the pressing and unexpected need to clear his throat and scratch the back of his neck at that spot where his neck joined to the shoulder, which always itched when he was nervous, and he did not want to move into the kiss as it was dark and he could accidentally knock teeth with Bethany. But then in his desire to avoid knocking teeth, he felt himself maybe leaning back and overcompensating, and he worried that Bethany might mistake his leaning away from her as a desire not to kiss, and she might stop. And then there was the matter of breathing, as in, do it? His first impulse was to hold his breath, but then he realized if she approached slowly enough, or if they kissed long enough, he would eventually run out of air and be forced to breathe mid-kiss and expel his lungs in a big poof right into her face or mouth. All of these thoughts happening roughly simultaneously in that brief moment before the kiss, Samuel's most rudimentary actions, his body's most automatic functions, sitting straight, being still, breathing, now turned crazily difficult by the prospect of the kiss, which is why when the kiss actually did successfully commence, it felt like a miracle. Mostly what Samuel felt during the kiss was relief that the kiss was happening, and also that Bethany's lips felt dry and chapped. This odd detail, that Bethany had chapped lips, it surprised him. In his imagination of her, Bethany seemed elevated beyond stupid earthly concerns. She did not seem to be the kind of girl whose lips ever chapped. On the way home that night, he was surprised that everything looked exactly the same as it did before, with absolutely no signs that the world had fundamentally, radically changed.
10. The first book Samuel ever wrote was a choose-your-own-adventure story called The Castle of No Return. It was 12 pages long. He illustrated it himself. Its premise, you were a brave knight fighting your way through a haunted castle to save a beautiful princess. Pretty standard fare, he knew. He was sure he'd read something similar in one of the many choose-your-own-adventure books that filled his bedroom shelves. He really had tried to come up with a better, more original story. He sat cross-legged on his floor and stared at the books before him and eventually decided they represented the full range of human possibility, the entire narrative spectrum. There were no other stories that could be told. Every idea that came to him was either imitative or stupid. And his book could not be stupid. The stakes were too high. Every kid was writing a book in an all-class contest where the winning author would have the book read aloud by the teacher. So, The Castle of No Return was derivative, so be it. He hoped his classmates would not be tired of the old tropes just yet. He hoped they would be comforted by the familiarity of the tale, like they were comforted by the old toys and blankets they sometimes hid in their backpacks. The next problem was plot. He knew choose-your-own-adventure books forked this way or that, then forked again and then again, and that each story was in the end a unified narrative whole, many stories in one. But his first draft of The Castle of No Return resembled more of a straight line with six short dead ends, with choices that would cause little debate or consternation. Do you want to go left or do you want to go right? If you go left, you die.
He hoped his classmates would forgive these shortcomings, the plagiarized setting, the lack of multiple cohesive plots, if he could find really interesting and creative and entertaining ways to die, which he did. Samuel had a talent, it turned out, for killing his characters interestingly. In one possible ending involving a trapdoor and a bottomless pit, Samuel wrote, "You are falling, and you fall forever, and even after you close this book and eat dinner and go to bed tonight and wake up tomorrow, you will still be falling," which just totally blew his mind. And he used the ghost stories his mother told him, all those old Norwegian stories that terrified him. He wrote about a white horse that appeared suddenly, offering a ride, and if the reader decided to mount the horse, terrible death quickly followed. In another ending, the reader becomes a ghost trapped inside of a leaf, too bad to go to heaven, too good to go to hell. He typed up the pages on his mother's old typewriter, leaving room for illustrations, which he did in crayon and pen. He bound the book in cardboard and blue fabric, and using a ruler to achieve perfectly straight lines, he wrote, "The Castle of No Return" on the cover. And maybe it was the illustrations, maybe it was the excellent blue binding, or maybe he left room in his mind for this possibility. Maybe it was the writing itself, the creative deaths, the unity of his vision, that instead of prologue, he used the word prolegomenon, which he found in a thesaurus and which he thought sounded awesome. He could not say for sure what swayed Miss Bowles, but swayed she was. He won. The Castle of No Return was read to the whole class, and he sat at his desk, trying not to burst. It was the best thing he'd done in his life. So when his mother came into his bedroom one morning and woke him and asked him weirdly, "What do you want to be when you grow up?" He still glowed with his literary victory, and so he said, quite sure of himself, "Novelist." The light outside was weakly blue. His eyes were still heavy and hazy. "A novelist?" she said, smiling. He nodded. Yes, a novelist. He had decided sometime in the night, as he relived his great success, how his classmates roared with pleasure when the princess was saved, their gratitude, their love, watching them navigate his story, surprised in the places he meant to surprise them, fooled in the places he meant to fool them, he felt like a god who knew all the answers to the big questions, peering down at the